The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. The premier sponsor for the City Club of Boise is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. The annual sponsor for the City Club is St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Catherine Himes.
Welcome to today's City Club Forum with Idaho Governor Brad Little. I'm Dr. Catherine Himes, Director of the University of Idaho McClure Center for Public Policy Research, City Club Forum Committee member, and moderator of today's forum. I would like to welcome our radio listeners to today's forum, joining us over Boise State University Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. Today's forum is available for our audience in large part because of our City Club sponsors and partners. I would like to take time to thank a few of these organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engage citizens, and a dynamic community. Thank you to our media partners, which include Boise State University Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, and Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, University of Idaho, Boise State University, and Northwest Nazarene University. Thank you also to today's forum sponsors, Idaho National Laboratory and First Interstate Bank. Following Governor Little's opening presentation today, there will be an opportunity for him to respond to audience questions. There are question cards at each of the tables. If you have a question, then please fill out one of the cards and hold it up for a volunteer to collect during the presentation and deliver to the forum moderator. The moderator will do her best to present each question and may group similar inquiries together in the essence of time. Today's City Club of Boise Forum is a conversation with Idaho's 33rd Governor, Brad Little. This dialogue will offer attendees a chance to ask questions of Governor Little about topics, including the initiatives outlined in his first year in office, supporting education, cutting red tape, promoting trade, improving broadband, fighting opioid misuse, forest health through shared stewardship, restoring salmon, regional government efficiency, and the 2020 census. We are delighted that 94 high school students are in attendance from Boise High School, Bora High School, Capitol High School, the Idaho Fine Arts Academy, and Riverstone International School. We look forward to your questions in particular. The people of Idaho elected Brad Little as the state's 33rd governor in November 2018. He became governor on January 7, 2019. Governor Little is an Emmett native who was raised on his family's sheep and cattle ranching operation. He graduated from the University of Idaho in 1977 with a Bachelor of Science in Agribusiness and has worked in the ranching industry for his entire professional life. In 1978, Brad married Teresa Sulin of Weezer. Teresa and Brad have two sons and six grandchildren. Brad first served in public office in 2001 when he was elected to fill a vacancy in the Idaho Senate. He was then elected to four consecutive terms to the Idaho Senate. During his service as a senator, Brad was elected by his Republican peers during his first full term to serve in party leadership as majority caucus chair. He then served as Idaho's 37th lieutenant governor starting in 2009. Brad is committed to making decisions through one lens, the lens of ensuring Idaho's children and grandchildren have the best opportunities to stay in Idaho and for the ones who have left to return. Please join me in welcoming Governor Little to the podium for his opening remarks.
Catherine gave my whole speech, so first question. For those of you that were either at the State of the State or glued to your television watching that riveting presentation, this will be a recap, so go ahead and update your Instagram, and Marlene, you can work on your Twitter account, but do it civilly, since we're at the City Club. No uncivil tweets why I'm giving my talk. Catherine talked about my goal. It's It really is pretty simple. And in fact, all the other initiatives that she talked about tie back to that. Sometimes it's a little bit of a stretch, but the more I think about it, it's really not that hard. You know, I can't guarantee anybody prosperity, but we should always default to whatever decisions create the best possible opportunity for that to be around. And, of course, I've been around long enough. I remember when we had real challenges in our economy, and we had an incredible export of our youth out of Idaho. And everybody agrees that we don't want to do that anymore. Now there's good, healthy disagreement about the rate of increase in our population, but nobody disagrees with the fact that we have our kids want to have the best possible opportunity to stay here. So how do you do that? Obviously, what most kids are interested in is a good career. They want higher wages, higher incomes. That's after taxes, after regulation, after the cost of health care. Those are all factors that determine whether a person has a pathway to prosperity. But to me, one of the biggest issues is education. One of the biggest hurdles for people not having prosperity is the fact that they, whether it's the fundamentals of K-12 or a career technical or higher education, those are all barriers to that prosperity going forward. And that's why I am so interested in that. And when I talk about education, I look at the budget, and I've been around for a little bit, as you heard, and one of the biggest dampers on resources being available for education has been the cost of corrections going up, our recidivism rate, and some of those challenges. So I'm going to talk about those two things quite a bit, and then I'll try and answer some questions. I want to go back to education. It's my number one priority, and it's one of the few things that's embedded in our state constitution, free, thorough, uniform system of public common schools. And more importantly, when that was written back in the 1890s, we didn't have the skills that are needed then that we did today, but it was still part of our forefathers that put that in the constitution. And so today, it's more important than it's ever been before. My work, and for the legislators that are in the room that supported me last year, thank you. I got a little more to do this year, and I'm going to need your help. And I will need all your help to advocate for them. But to me, if I'm going to spend half my money on K-12, half of your money on K-12, there's no excuse for us to not have a higher rate of literacy. If these kids can't read proficiently by the end of the third grade, a lot of the rest of those investments are for naught. And so I coined this that we should prepare our students today so we don't have to repair them later. And but that means all options. There's certain people that want to do one thing or another. And having spent the amount of time I do going around to the school districts, these kids are different. Communities are different. Their opportunities are different. So if we agree that the Idaho Reading Initiative, is the IRI, is the gold standard, we tell them, and Bill Gilbert, who co-chaired my task force, that was one their number one recommendation, along with the other members of the task force, was we want you to move that needle on reading proficiency. I'm going to Parma for Capital for a day on Friday, and I was looking over their incredible work that they're doing in Parma in that area. And, you know, Parma's got 10% English language learners, 30% Hispanics, 54% kids that come from a challenging background. And if they can do it at Parma, they can do it anywhere. And we've got areas of the state where they're really doing it. So that's obviously one of my biggest priorities, because if we can get them reading, all those other things we're doing, STEM, career technical, higher education, get easier. And so that's why that's so important to me. Secondly, to do that, we have to honor the profession of teaching. Last year, with the legislators' help, we started moving starting teacher pay up to $40,000. This year, we'll complete this progress, knock on wood, to get it to $40,000. But we have to recognize, as the task force pointed out, we have to recognize the fact that we've got veterans teachers that have really got, particularly in the border communities, have got a lot of challenges. Teachers can just drive 2, 3, 5 miles and get $10,000-$15,000 more. That's not always the case, but that's part of it. So for us to retain, for us to send the message, we have to put money into the what's called the grid for those veteran teachers, and we're going to work on that this session also. We can no longer, as I said, rely on the good hearts of these teachers to do that. We need to recognize what they do for us. And, in fact, you'll hear a lot from the legislature about property taxes. A lot of the supplemental levies, the reason the patrons are voting for those supplemental levies is the undying need to be competitive, particularly if you go to Coeur d'Alene and dig out their supplemental levies, how much of that's there to make them competitive. Good for them for doing that, but the state ought to, we ought to step up our part for that. So I just left before I came here. The career technical people are a couple blocks away, and there's actually a lot going on, but it's very diversified. We've got way more CTE taking place in the K-12 system than we had before. It used to be you had a table saw and a lathe and a welder and a, some tools to tune a car, and now the skills that these kids need and what they need for facilities has gone way up. The bigger districts have an advantage. And so it's important to us to try and scale it out to the smaller districts. I used to represent Canyon County and the CASA model over there, which is where all those small districts get together, combine their resources, and provide career technical, is a great model. Just this week or last week, in Shoshone County, Mullen, Kellogg, and Wallace announced the same thing. We've got it in Minnecashia. We've got it in Kootenai County. We need to scale that out all over the state to where those opportunities are there. We expanded advanced opportunities to be in the career technical area, and that should also help. This year, we are going forward. Director Revere is here with our Job Corps program over in Canyon County, which will be tied to Burt's CWI facility for 150 students, and we get that up and going. We want to scale that around the state, that program also. The Workforce Development Council, the Idaho Department of Labor continue to work to facilitate more internships and apprenticeships. In higher ed, there's nobody from higher ed in this room. In higher ed, obviously this year, we're continuing on my effort that started last year to fund opportunity scholarships. The increase in general funding for opportunity scholarships ongoing is a 36% advancement. But, you know, higher ed, like all the other entities except for K-12, had to go through the reset. The reason we're doing the reset is there was a federal tax bill passed that Idaho almost always adopts the federal code, and we adopted the federal code, and as a result, and you'll hear this a lot, even though our economy is going like this, our revenue tailed off, and I go back to my fundamental underpinning. If I want to have opportunities for prosperity, if I want to address all those other things, I got to match up my state revenue with my state expenses. So this was hopefully a one-time, I'm quite certain it will be, particularly if they put money into the rainy day fund, to where when we get through at the end of this next fiscal year, Idaho will be right-sized and we can continue to invest in whatever your choice is, education, tax relief, more other opportunities, but we'll have that match-up between income and expenses the way we need to it. And of course, higher ed also receives the benefit of advanced opportunity. I was in a meeting this morning, and I'm actually in a meeting with all the presidents this afternoon to talk about how that's working and what we can do to improve it. But I am committed to working with higher education to look at hopefully a consensus between all the presidents, between my state board, between all the people that have a piece of an interest in higher ed on how do we go forward. Is it outcome-based? Is it enrollment-based? Is it scholarships? Is it line items? And because of our diversity in higher education, that's always a challenge. I admit, I plead guilty to the fact that in the last year I've been focused on the K-12. Because of the good work they did, now I've got a chance to focus on this going forward, and I'm going to tell them that this afternoon. I'm trying to soften them up before I meet with them later. I want to go back to the corrections issue. You know, as I said, when I look at our budget and look at what's hampered our ability to do the right thing, it's been the cost of corrections. And it's interesting to me, the proposal that my corrections board put forth, what I put in the budget, what's going on is it's a really good consensus that we have got to fix this. We have got to stop that revolving door of people that go in and out. Nobody is proud of the fact that in Idaho we have the highest percent of people that go in and out that are just basically guilty of violating their parole. And so Josh T. Walt and the Board of Corrections made some great proposals to me. They're up making their case to the legislature. We have got to put some money into this and stop that. We've got to make sure that these people, when they go out of our correction system, are productive members of society, the society's safe, and that we break that cycle of recidivism and the revolving door. And so there's we got reentry programs. We've got our new, I can't ever remember the name, community reentry centers that we've got that we're working on. But all of these total, the net effect of it is that $100 million that we're spending on those, that money's going to come back to the state and to the taxpayers. But we've got a short-term problem and a long-term problem in corrections, and right now we've got to address both of them at the same thing. We have some of the best mental health courts, substance abuse courts, family courts, veteran courts in the whole United States, but they don't do any good if I don't have a place that those people that are in those courts know that if they violate the contract that they have with the judge, that they'll go into a facility. And the other thing is we've got to have training in there. So that's a big deal to me. I am appreciative of the warm reception it's gotten from the legislature so far. Those are kind of the big things that are on my dance card. But let's get up here and I see people just excited to ask Catherine questions. So thank you very much.
Great. We have a large stack of questions from the audience, and a lot of them have to do with topics that the governor mentioned in his opening remarks. But some are on other topics, and I want to come to those first so we can have a pretty broad conversation before going deep. And I want to talk about salmon. We've had a lot of questions from students with respect to how are you planning to rebuild the salmon population. Let's talk about different parts of the state and salmon, as well as how does this connect to your philosophy with children and grandchildren?
Well, as most of you know, we put together a very broad group of people to address the salmon issue. The salmon issue, obviously, there's some of the things that I can't, I didn't see it when I did my oath of office that I could change ocean conditions, which would be helpful. As a matter of fact, if I could do that, a lot of those other problems would get to be less. But the factors that we control in the state of Idaho, harvest, when do we release water, the timing of water, how do we operate dams, what do we do for habitat, all those other things, and, I think for the most part, the people I talk to that are on that very broad-based, very regionally-based, believe they're making progress. I know that I'll get the question, so I'll address it now. And as the minute I started this, I could see everybody was going to go to breaching of the dams. And I said, let's just, if breaching of the dams is going to get in the way of all those other things that I can do, I'm suggesting, strongly suggesting, that let's talk about those other things that we can do. There's an EIS that's going forward right now that's going to talk about how we operate the dams. There's some federal legislation that's taking place. I'm saying let's do what we can do right now and then pray for a little better ocean conditions.
Great. One other question with respect to the environment. This has to do with public land and forest land. What are your thoughts about the environment? What's your goal for this year? And do you have any specific plans regarding?
Well, we got a lot of public lands in Idaho. Some of these initiatives Governor Otter started. And, in fact, a lot of these initiatives, when I travel from a lot of the other states, they ask about it, particularly California. I'd say there's an 85 to 90% consensus that these multiple use grounds, what I call the roaded front, that we've got to do a better job of managing them, that nobody likes the catastrophic fires, nobody likes the risk to wildlife habitat, to water habitat. It's actually a salmon issue in some areas. And so we have raised our hand, Idaho's raised our hand and said, look, we've got rules on private land and we've got operations on state lands. Because the federal government has been financially challenged and regulatorily challenged, we will be active participants in better management of those lands, either through Good Neighbor, which is us managing timber sales, or shared stewardship, where we coordinate the private, the state, and the federal land together. I think by any measurement, when I talk to both the BLM and the Forest Service, when I talk to other groups, that's going to be successful. But we got a long way to go. We literally have millions of acres we got to treat, and it's going to take us a while to get there. But I like the trajectory we have right now.
Let's shift gears. Literally, we're going to talk transportation. There are several questions with respect to the transportation infrastructure, what's available publicly, road maintenance in particular, road failure, the challenges in certain parts of the state, and then finally a rail system, if that might be possible for Idaho.
Well, let me eat this dinosaur. First off, I've been an advocate, and many of you in the room know I chaired the former governor's task force on transportation in 2010, and since then there's been a little. We've raised fuel taxes, we've raised registration, and in fact, when we did that study, the bridges in Idaho that were engineered to last 60 years. We're going to have to last 120 years. We've got that down into the 100 and less factor, but we still got a long way to go, and that's the bridge issue and the maintenance issue, which is an issue. But the more probably pressing issue in this room and in this valley and in most of our urban areas, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho Falls, Twin, Pocatello, in those areas is the congestion issue. I always say that the most precious commodity, besides your children, that any of you have is your time, and congestion is diminutive to that to a large extent. It's also a break on business development. There's a current study being done between the Associated General Contractors and the cities, and I look forward to that. But there are actually several options that have I've had plenty of conversations with the leaders on transportation, the legislature, have been in my office. And I'm saying I'm all in, but remember I said the same thing about transportation funding that I said about tax relief. If it doesn't impede my ability to do the investments in education, which would mean take money out of the general fund, I'm very interested. But at this point in time, there's probably Chuck, 10 options up there that are bouncing around, and I look forward to them. But I am, I've told everybody I'm all in to put more money into transportation, just as long as it doesn't hurt those other things.
Before we continue with questions from the audience, I'd like to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to a City Club of Boise Forum with Idaho Governor Brad Little. Governor Little, you discussed wanting people to remain and return to Idaho because of the wage and job opportunities, but Idaho's minimum wage remains one of the lowest in the country. Do you have any plans to change the minimum wage to account for higher costs of living and inflation?
Well, first off, I somewhat object to it being called the minimum wage because it really is a starting wage, and there shouldn't be people stuck in the starting wage. Part of the issue with it is a starting wage in Boise or Ketchum is way different than a starting wage in Dubois or wherever. Name your small rural town that doesn't have a housing problem. So that's the fundamental part of it. The number of people that are getting paid minimum wage in Idaho is a real small number. If the initiative passes or something happens on minimum wage, it's not going to break my heart. But what's important to me is if you look at the statistics about what happens if people don't start working and don't continue working and don't get started, and the further you raise that up to where people with some limited skills, some whatever it is, don't get started in the process, it has a snowball effect about them not getting into the system. I like a starting wage that gets people started. You know, there's no way you can live on your own under the minimum wage. There's no way you can raise a family under the minimum wage. But in this valley, I am hard-pressed, other than in the restaurant business where they get tips, to talk to anybody that pays the minimum wage.
The next series of questions has to do with growth. And a lot of these questions are actually coming from students. So some of the questions are specific to Boise, but I think they could be generalizable to growth in Idaho. And it includes everything from how do we preserve wild space, wild habitats? What about homelessness and pollution?
Well, open space, I'm actually old enough that I remember when, one of the most precious things people in urban Boise talk about is the Boise Front. And as the population of Boise has tripled, the care and feeding and preservation of the Boise Front has gone up because people have participated. It's a miserable piece of real estate to manage because you've got the Forest Service, the BLM, the state, multiple private landowners, the Army Corps, the fish and game. But because of the pressure from this community, and I actually served on the committee that did that, we put together a plan to take an overloved, underutilized piece of real estate and make it one of the best amenities for the state of Idaho. So even with population increases, if people get together collectively and agree to do the right thing will happen. So there's kind of my prima facie evidence about you got to manage it. This goes back to the issue with the federal government and shared stewardship. A lot of the federal ground, they just don't have enough resources to do the right thing. The number of people they have out there, and that's why in some areas, nonprofits, fill in the blank who it is, are going out and trying to take care of the care and feeding of those lands. And as the population increases, if people have more free time, that's going to get to be more and more important as we go forward.
Do you mind touching on the homelessness question from the student?
Sure. The city of Boise, if you travel around the West, the city of Boise, to their credit, I get around Boise quite a bit, even early in the morning. And for a city this size, the programs that they put in place, and some of them are city programs, some of them are nonprofits, some of them are faith-based, they really have addressed that. It's not perfect, but you don't have to travel very far to urban areas in the West, and you say, well, whatever they're doing, Boise looks pretty good compared to everywhere else. This is one of those problems you have to be diligent, you have to continue to work on it, and we should. But the issue on homelessness now is housing affordability. And some of the things you do in housing affordability, you want to be sure that you vet those out because the unintended consequences of some of the thing you do on housing affordability does almost the opposite. It's interesting in the Valley what the entrepreneurs are doing, and as the level of skills required, Garrett Nankolis isn't here, so I can say this. Entrepreneurs are putting a lot of their jobs in the far end of the Valley because there's more affordable housing there. They're putting them in the far end of the Valley because real estate's cheaper. They're putting them in the far end of the Valley because they can get their people back and forth to work. You know, they can buy places in Notice and Parma and Wilder and Greenleaf where they couldn't buy them here. So the magic of free enterprise, the individual entrepreneur, without the heavy hand of government, are in essence addressing some of those problems. I'm a big advocate for rural Idaho, and so whatever we do from a housing standpoint, I'm always trying to get jobs out, particularly where there's communities that have available infrastructure, have available housing. That's getting to be harder and harder to do in Idaho right now.
Thanks, Governor. What are your plans to combat the opioid epidemic in the state of Idaho? Do you feel it's a priority at the moment?
It is a big priority, and it's a huge priority for me. Melinda Smizer is here in the room that runs my Office of Drug Policy, and she's chairing a group that are looking at it, and it's a big deal. You know, if I was king, I'd say no more opioids. But the problem with that is what the unintended consequence. People go to heroin, people go to fentanyl, people go to all kinds of problems. So the fact that we have this problem today, it's kind of like my corrections problem. I got some short-term stuff I got to do, and I got some long-term stuff I got to do. And the short-term stuff is our prescription management plan, where we basically are a gentle reminder to doctors and pharmacists that there are people that are buying opioids for less than chronic pain reasons. And in our prescription management plan, when we started off, there were like, you know, we got 1.78 million people in Idaho. We started out with like 300,000 hits on that program. So if you go into a pharmacy or you go to a doctor, they said, was Brad across the street at a pharmacy or down the block at a doctor trying to get an opioid prescription before? We started off at that low number. Last year we had 22 million hits on that program. And part of what we've done is we've reached out to Oregon. We've just got an agreement with Washington, so the people that are on border communities are going back and forth and trying to find opioids. Now, that's one part of it. The other part of it is what we do with substance abuse, mental health. Almost all of these issues are dual diagnosed. They've got a substance abuse problem called a mental health problem, or the mental health problem caused a substance abuse problem. I'm very proud, and I think we're going to do it right away. The executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch are all going to do resolutions or orders to put together a behavioral health group to look at all the things we're doing on behavioral health and substance abuse. Opioids are going to be a big part of that.
Do you think that renewable energy should be a priority for the future of Idaho? How would you accomplish this goal?
Well, we started off with mostly renewable energy, which is hydropower. We've got one of the largest footprints for hydropower of any state in the union. B, we've got some of the most affordable. But without government getting involved, you know, a lot of states around us put in renewable portfolio standards where they put a gun to the head of their utilities and say, you got to have more wind, you got to have more solar. We didn't do that in Idaho. We allowed the utilities, the individual entrepreneurs, the bankers, the financiers, and as a result, we have on a trajectory, you know, we've got two of our biggest utilities that in the next score of years are going to have 100% renewable energy. And that's by letting the marketplace work. Go try and finance a coal plant. It just doesn't happen. Bankers, consumers, everybody's participating in that. I always look at government as our first obligation is, are there barriers to doing the right thing? Are there barriers to putting in wind? Are there barriers to put in solar? Are there barriers to put in transition so I can get solar or wind from where it is to where it needs to be? That's the government's role. But I believe consumers, the finance industry, and the utilities are all going in a direction that will have a very, very green portfolio. When I'm doing economic development, people from other countries and other states say they're coming to Idaho because of our green portfolio.
Thank you. There are a lot of questions related to K through 12 education.
I'll give shorter answers.
Oh, no, I wanted to just switch to going deep. So there are K through 12 education questions, higher education questions, and a lot of them have to do with literacy. And I think this question really captures all of them very well. If you could do one thing to reach your gold standard with respect to third grade reading, the goal for Idaho, what would you do, or what could an individual do?
I said it a little earlier. There is no one solution. And that's why I really like my smorgasbord. Summer reading programs, kindergarten, pre-K funded, however pre-K is funded, busing to kindergarten. We've got some districts where the kids that need to go to kindergarten the most don't have even access to busing. So books, library programs. There was a program that we don't have now that Governor Kempthorne started called Parents as Teachers, which were circuit riders that went around to help interested parents that wanted to make sure their kids were reading or prepared for school, their colors, their numbers, their letters, get them started. And so my one thing is to give them the resources to get there, because these kids are different. Kids today have so many more challenges than they did not too long ago because of a variety of problems in society. We just need to give our local trustees, our administrators, and our teachers the tools they need to get those kids up reading. It's my highest priority, but there's not one thing we can do other than we want them reading proficiently by the end of the third grade. You figure out what the limitation is.
Let's talk about the Go On goal. What are your priorities with respect to Go On?
Well, the resolution passed by the legislature to verify the state board's 60% goal was that I testified it in both the House and Senate, but I did say the caveat when I gave both of them, when I got questions about how are you going to get this done, is that we need to expand the scope of the CTE part of that. You know, the go-on rate, to me, is an issue of how do people comfortably live, feed their families, and comfortably plan for retirement. And being a plumber or a welder or a whatever the CTE job is gets him to there, that, you know, we may want to, from a standard standpoint, look at that 60%. We've still got a huge unmet need in traditional higher education, in associate degrees. It's all those options right there. But to move that up, I think we're going to expand that. But I don't want to expand it to the point to where we make it to where they take one class and all of a sudden I check the box. Because it isn't checking the box on 60%. It's solving our workforce challenges and providing those students with the best possible opportunity to live comfortably and plan for retirement.
Thank you. Will you also speak about early childhood education and what are some efforts that may be taking shape this year?
Well, there's a lot going on. I mean, if you look at the acceleration in kindergarten, if you look at the acceleration, you know, this valley, we're sitting right now in both ends of this valley, the Basin School District up at Idaho City and Caldwell, they have pre-K programs. I actually talked to a superintendent out of this valley at a very small rural area where they are putting in a pre-K program. Some of it's faith-based. This one is not. This is the local community's doing it. It would be hypocritical for me when my grandkids all had pre-K opportunities to say I'm not for it. But I got to get done what I can get done, and what I can get done is more money into that K through 3 period, kindergarten, whatever it is to get done, but the whole issue of preparing those kids to read proficiently at the end of the third grade, I'm all in. I believe I can get done what I can get done. I'm just trying not to bite off too much right now.
Would you connect the dots on Idaho's economy, international trade, and foreign policy? I know that you've been on some trade missions, I think some to the east and some to the west.
Well, you know, Idaho's always been challenged from a location standpoint because of our location. Obviously, Asia is a better destination for us. We have in Idaho the longest continuous serving trade representative of anybody in the Asian countries, Eddie Yen, who is perhaps the most underpaid state employee I have. Those trade relations take a long time to cultivate. You need to understand what their consumers want. It's a different culture. You need to understand their culture. But we, given the fact that we're a small state, we just specialize in three areas, Taiwan, China, and Mexico. I met with Senator Winder and some of our Canadian counterparts yesterday. We don't have much friction doing business with Canada because we've got a lot of connections. But we emphasize those three areas, and we try and encourage our companies to build those long-term relationships. You know, our biggest private employer in Idaho is Micron, and they sell semiconductors all over the world, and we're very proud of that. But we've also got some really, really small companies that have built relations because of trade missions, what Eddie's done, what Commerce has done, what Ag has done, that have really been a good base for continued expansion in Idaho. So we've got multiple solutions, but we kind of have to stay attentive to our knitting and try and not do too many things, so we do the things we do well, and that's what we try and do.
I think it was last week you had an executive order about parental leave. And this question has to do with teachers and parental leave. So the question has to do with many public employees, specifically school teachers, do not receive one day of maternity or paternity leave. So does your executive order cover those teachers, and do you have any plans with respect to teachers?
Well, I cover who I cover. I don't, you know, I negotiate with all the state employees, but I don't negotiate with the teachers. So as I said at some point in time, I like to lead by example, and I'm hoping this example will be the leadership that that other companies in the school districts look at.
There are a lot of questions from students around climate change. Related to water, climate change broadly, and they're wondering what active steps can the state take in the next few years to mitigate and adapt to the effects of climate change?
Well, look out the window. Again, this kind of goes back to the energy question, is the first thing we should do is look at what we're doing to prevent people from doing the right thing to adjust to it. We know that the state of Idaho, whether you're interested in salmon, river rafting, snow skiing, agriculture, city water for cities, that snow is a very, very important component of what we have in Idaho. We know that climates have always changed going back and forth. But, you know, the preponderance of the evidence is that the things are happening pretty fast. And so what do we do about that, the snow issue? What do we do about replacing the water that we used to stay in July and even early August up in the mountains? What do we do about challenges to the aquifer? We actually have a pretty robust plan, particularly when you look at the other states and what we're doing about recharging the aquifer. Some of the forest health issues, in fact, I'm a somewhat practicing range scientist in my old life. Some of the things we do and how we manage those lands will better retain that moisture there. But the main thing for government is to get out of the way and let people that recognize there's a challenge there be as adaptive as possible, because Like I said, it's a big part of the fish issue. Water temperature, as far as whether it be any of our anadromous fish, bull trout, pick your species, water temperature is a big part of that. So how do we manage those ecosystems to where that temperature variability isn't any more than it has to be?
Will you talk about the First Lady and her work and her priorities?
I sent a we had dinner last night. I sent a note to somebody that made a very gracious invitation, and Teresa made this and all on her own made this determination that everybody wants to know what her cause is. And she said, there's way too many good causes in Idaho. I'm not going to pick one cause and have that be mine. She's incredibly dedicated to our family and to the long-term interests of Idaho. We are kind of a unique family in that we have relatives from almost the far north to the east. So we have connections all over the state of Idaho, and that's important to both of us. But she is, other than maybe women's suffrage, which it's kind of a timing issue because the 19th Amendment this summer, and the fact that her great-great-grandfather in 1895 voted for it. And then I just found out just recently that my great-great-uncle did, but I had to check and make sure he voted right with her grandfather on women's, so I was relieved to see that. But other than that, she just opened to what, kind of what she thinks is important, but she doesn't have one thing that she's doing. And when she first started talking about that, but the request we get all the time, it was a brilliant move by her she's obviously interested in children. We've got 6 grandchildren. She's interested in those things. But she just wants what's best for Idaho and does not have a single initiative. And actually, it was a brilliant move by her.
So I have several questions related to young people interested in running for office. And I'm going to read 2 of them and then wrap them together. So I think they'll make you smile. Is there still room in the Republican Party for moderates, especially in the legislature? With terms such as okay boomer becoming common in the political realm of communication, what do you suggest to fix the generational communication problems that plague politics? So what advice would you give to a young person who wants to enter politics?
Well, I'm sure that some of you feel that way, but that is not the first time somebody's asked that question. In Idaho, we have a part-time legislature, and because not a very well-paid part-time legislature, and county commissioners are not very well paid. A lot of them are part-time. So as a result of that, the age of the elected official is older than the demographics of the population. That's always been the case. But that doesn't mean you can't participate, you can't be active. And, of course, it's a lot of it's just about the curious mind. It's just about, what interests you? What part of politics interests you? Sandra Day O'Connor did a great job in trying to inspire students to be more civically minded. City Club does a great job of doing that. I notice there's not a lot of young members of the City Club except for the students that participate here. But when I go around and I talk to a lot of students, I'm very impressed with the kind of questions they ask. There's some of them that are zoned out, but when I was their age, I was kind of zoned out too. So,
I have a question about people moving to Idaho. A lot of people coming are, as this person says, older, and they're everyone who's here is also aging. The question has to do with what will you do to support older populations in Idaho?
Well, it depends where you are. I think right here where we're sitting, you'll find that a lot of people that are moving to Idaho are younger because of the industry that we have within a not a very wide circumference from where we're sitting right here. But you get to other parts of the state, a lot of the reason they're older is, we talk about housing affordability, but relative to Seattle or San Francisco or Los Angeles or fill in the blank, it's cheaper here. and they like a big part of it. Some of them are here, thought they were going to retire, and I run into them. They're involved in things all the time. I don't know. Obviously, when they come here, a lot of them are interested in hunting and fishing and parks and recreation, and we need to continue to do that because not only is it good for the older people, it's good for the younger people. So we should continue to do whatever we do either through local government, state government, or privately to do that. Probably the bigger issue to me with the older demographics is what it does to our health care, the fact that it puts a bigger stress on health care. We are increasing the number of residents. We're moving the needle on physician's assistants, on nurse practitioners, on psychologists, on all those areas, and a lot of those are going to be needed to address that older demographic.
Idaho's part of the Western Governors Association. What is this organization? How does Idaho work with it? Do you set shared priorities? How often are you together?
Well, the Western Governors Association is kind of a unique group because, you know, there's the National Governors Association where they very seldom agree on anything. And then there's Republican governors and Democratic governors. The Western governors probably above all, and it's about half Republican and half Democrat. But we get together and roll up our sleeves and try and address problems. You talked earlier about Good Neighbor. That was a direct result of a conversation with the Secretary of Agriculture at the Western Governors Association. Right now, Doug Burgum from North Dakota is the chairman. Next year, it'll be Kate Brown from Oregon. Pretty big delta between those two governors right there. But that doesn't mean we can't sit down and get things done collectively. From a regional standpoint, we have a lot of common challenges, and just the opportunity for us to get together and talk about their challenges has been, for me, a very good investment for the state of Idaho.
Governor Little, are there any final words that you would like to share with our audience?
No, other than I didn't look and see if my name tag's still here. I didn't pay my dues this year. Sorry about that. Ed Stimson and I served on a board together for quite a while. So I've been a big fan of the City Club and Idaho Falls and Twin and the dialogue that you have here. I'm a different person from the meetings that I've attended at the City Club. People might think of me as a redneck renegade rancher from Emmett, but I have spent some time at City Club, so I do have some creds. But it is such an important forum to have the discussions that are important. And so for all of you that participate, congratulations and thank you.
Please join me in thanking Idaho Governor Brad Little for participating in today's forum.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise. The City Club is a nonpartisan forum with the motto, "Things happen when people start talking." This broadcast was made possible with help from the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, KBOI, and Boise State Public Radio. Additional support comes from the University of Idaho, Boise State University, and Northwest Nazarene University. Forum series sponsors for the City Club of Boise are AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Concordia University School of Law, Echelon Group, Micron, and Pacific Source Health Plans. Additional grant funding comes from the Idaho Humanities Council, a state-based partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org.